What is the allure for members of the community of Pinehouse, Saskatchewan to accept nuclear waste in their area? Have community members been adequately consulted? How have the social and economic dynamics of the community been altered by the presence of the nuclear industry? What are the consequences for town residents of speaking out against the collaboration agreement signed by the Métis community's mayor and council? Can a gag order encompass an entire community? A concerned citizen, Dale Smith, shares his perspective on the fight against the planned nuclear waste repository in northern Saskatchewan and the personal costs associated with that resistance. On today's program, Packed with the Nuclear Devil, a Saskatchewan activist's story. Bringing you the analysis beyond the headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of November 8th, 2013. I'm your host, Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We seek to provide listeners with access to analysis of some of the major stories shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. Our show is also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. The Department of Homeland Security is to spend $19 million on a private security force in Wisconsin and Minnesota, an armed unit that must have a top secret security clearance, according to an official solicitation. The fact that the contractors being hired must have a top secret security clearance clearly suggests that the DHS is not merely seeking to hire armed guards, but Blackwater-style mercenaries who will be engaged in some kind of clandestine activity. The notion of an armed security force operating domestically under a top secret designation, something normally reserved for foreign spying and military operations, underscores how the DHS increasingly treats America like some kind of occupied territory. The hiring of private mercenaries with top secret clearances also suggests the DHS may be planning on using the contractors as cutouts who will be involved in a variety of different operations outside the purview of public and congressional scrutiny. The DHS's purchase of over 1.6 billion rounds of ammunition over the course of the last 12 months has also prompted concerns that the feds are gearing up for trouble. That's from the article, Is Homeland Security Building a Mercenary Unit? DHS to Hire Top Secret Domestic Security Force by Paul Joseph Watson, posted November 6, 2013, originally appearing at Infowars.com. We've been reporting for years that huge quantities of debris from the Japanese tsunami would hit the west coast of North America. The Independent reports, an enormous floating island of debris from Japan's 2011 tsunami is drifting towards the coast of America, bringing with it over 1 million tons of junk that would cover an area the size of Texas. The most concentrated stretch, dubbed the Toxic Monster by Fox News, is currently around 1,700 miles off the coast, sitting between Hawaii and California, but several million tons of additional debris remains scattered across the Pacific. If the rubbish were to continue to fuse, the combined area of the floating junkyard would be greater than that of the United States and could theoretically weigh up to 5 million tons. That's from the article, Texas-sized island of Japanese debris to hit the west coast of North America, by Washington's blog, posted November 6th. Originally posted in Washington's blog. The forensic tests on samples taken from Yasser Arafat's corpse by a team of Swiss scientists exhibit high levels of radioactive polonium-210. The exhumation of his body was implemented in November 2012. The samples revealed, quote, levels of polonium at least 18 times higher than usual in Arafat's ribs, pelvis, and in soil that absorbed his bodily fluids, unquote. These developments raise the broader issue which the media has failed to address. Who was behind this assassination of Yasser Arafat? What recent news reports fail to mention is that the extrajudicial assassination had been ordered by the Israeli cabinet in 2003. That is from the article, "The Assassination of Yasser Arafat Was Ordered by the Israeli Cabinet. We Will Choose the Right Way and the Right Time to Kill Arafat," by Michel Chosadovsky, posted November 7th. Leaked documents have revealed evidence of a plot to destabilize Venezuela and undermine the rule of leftist president Nicolás Maduro. Documents obtained by a contributor to RT's Spanish channel, Eva Golinger, detail a structured plan to erode the stability of Venezuela with a view to, quote, returning real democracy and independence that have been hijacked for more than 14 years, unquote. The plans are allegedly the product of a conference between American company FTI Consulting and two right-wing Colombian groups affiliated with former President Alvaro Uribe in the Colombian city of Cúcuta in June of this year. The strategies to be employed include, quote, creating crisis on the streets, facilitating the intervention of North America and NATO forces with the Colombian army, unquote, power cuts, food shortages, support and financing of the political opposition. The documents writes that violence should also be encouraged and, quote, whenever possible lead to deaths and injuries, unquote. That is from the article, "Leaked Document Reveals Plot to Destabilize Venezuelan Government, U.S. Embassy Officials Encouraging Acts of Sabotage," by Russia Today, posted November 6th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. As described on last week's program, communities in northern Saskatchewan are being aggressively courted by the Nuclear Waste Management Organization to accept radioactive waste from eastern Canada. One of these communities is Pinehouse, which is centrally located in Saskatchewan's boreal forest, about 500 kilometers north of Saskatoon. Pinehouse is a mostly Métis community with a population of about 1,000. After the town had signed a collaboration agreement with uranium giants Cameco and Areva, a statement of claim against the companies and three levels of government was filed. One of those plaintiffs was Pinehouse resident Dale Smith. Smith is a wild rice harvester and fisherman. He has become active with the Committee for Future Generations, which is attempting to stop northern Saskatchewan from becoming a nuclear waste dump. The following interview was conducted in Saskatoon in late October during the Council of Canadians annual general meeting, which honored Smith and his colleagues with an award for activism. Here he explains the concerns he has about the proposal and the process and how his battle has taken a toll on him personally.
The industry coming in now is forcing the community, it's maneuvering the town to think a certain way, more of industry, education, not so much the traditional knowledge. There's starting to be a letting go. We want the cabins, we want the fishing, we want, but there's not really anything really real. What I mean by that, I guess to explain better, is that without complicating the matter, the fishery of Saskatchewan, we broke out of the monopoly that freshwater fish marketing out of Winnipeg. That's the headquarters. That's where our fish goes. We broke away from that, wishing to start our own province-owned, which would be more we'd be more reliant on. So when that didn't happen, we kind of waited a couple of years already, and we put our shares into it, hoping something would come out of it, and it seems to be failing because industry doesn't really necessarily support those type of resource revenue for the communities, fishing wild rice, berry picking. Our traditional activities for it doesn't mix because we really need the land pure in every form, and if the companies aren't willing to do the assessments needed to guarantee that what they're doing is safe for us, well, now there's talk of this stuff because of the deals that are being made by these corporations. And right now, the only corporation we're dealing with is uranium mining. Before, it was forestry also. Did that come to my mind? So,
are you saying that, I mean, there were these sort of subtle incentives, just sort of creeping, like changes in the way your community operated, so you had all these, like the schools and all these other elements that were largely foreign, but once they were there, then ultimately, you know, you depended on these outside industries like Cameco to sustain them, even in the face of, so in effect, going back to the way your father and his family would have depended on the land is less of an option now?
Yes, more and more. And that type of traditional knowledge, what we're hearing now from our leaders is that it's dying. Fishery is dying. Trapping is long dead because hardly anybody does it now, even though the prices are much better than our time. But because of inflation, cost of gas, being in a northern settlement, it's hard to compete with that and try and maintain a traditional lifestyle when your skidoo is worth $7,000, $10,000. And one piston goes, there's $2,000 to fix it, which you just cannot, it's harder to do in a traditional lifestyle because of so much change that is taking place on the community level. So we're having to adapt in ways that are fairly new to our identity as Native people. And what I mean by that is if we were nomadic, in a sense, trappers, fishermen, the money we made come from a consistent fishery and the trappers. So if the fishing slowed down, we compensated with the trapping. So there's this balance with nature. So you learn to respect it in ways that you had to, because that was the way of life. When we started becoming dependent on a grade 12 education, and then you had to get further training to get into the mines, to get into other careers, not just mines, You had to either let go of that lifestyle, the mindset of it, the peace of being out on a trap line. You're actually letting go because you got to go to the city now. You got to go to a classroom setting. And that's not normal for Native people to interact with their environment like that. So there's a very change that is taking place, especially in my generation, because we have this sense that we are wiser than our parents. And I had to break myself from that with my dad because I just kept resisting. You know, I try to live the lifestyle of fishing, and I've been doing it. Now my wife is the licensed fisherman because I let mine go. I gave mine to my brother, my older brother, because he wanted to go into that. And he loves it. He's more of a fisherman than I ever was. But he had the upbringing. He had the love for that. I did it because I had to for survival. So when industry comes in like that, it breaks these intimate connections that we had with each other as family and the dynamics of the community, how we talk to each other. Now when somebody makes $100,000 a year and you question the safety of what they're doing, they're concerned that, well, how much do you know? Is this stuff safe? Is uranium safe? What if it spills on you? What if these trucks overturns and falls into a river with these drums and it spills open? How do we clean it up if it's going to flow right into our lake? So what effects? So we start questioning industry and leadership with these simple questions because we see it on a daily basis because we're the first impact community.
So people in your community have reason to be concerned for their health and for, you know, the other impacts overall. And yet it seems as if you are isolated within your community and that it's costing you. It's costing you relationships. Can you help us understand why that's happening?
Well, I have two brothers that work in the mine, a younger and an older brother. And I have two other brothers who had worked in the mines, part-time, and then one many years ago. He had since quit, and he's fishing now. But my family, four of us, four brothers worked on that industry. When a nuclear waste issue started, because our town, our leadership put up, we just said, well, we're going to discuss this. And I remember that I was present at that meeting. A public meeting was held to see if they should pursue this. And I put my foot down right away. And I said that if we were to listen to the elders, we would just obey them. If they say, don't go into this, we shouldn't. We shouldn't question their wisdom. So my suggestion for the council, the leadership, is you do not pursue this. And lo and behold, here I am today with a lawsuit against my own community, my own Métis society, my own local, my own nation. And I'm suing the mayor. We're suing, I'm not the only one, but we're suing another representative from the Métis local. We're suing the government, Saskatchewan government, and the Canadian government, and the mining company, Cameco and Areva, the two mining companies. So I'm, to make the long story short, the town signed a $200 million deal with Cameco, Areva, a collaboration agreement. It's on the website of Committee for Future Generations. If you want to look more into it in terms of how it happened, because we never seen a document on a community scale or on the Métis Nation side until after the signing. But we did receive a summary of the agreement from our leadership, along with the lawyer representing the town, all paid for by Cameco, the mining companies, the whole process. So they signed a confidentiality agreement right at the beginning, but we weren't they didn't come outright and say it. We signed a confidentiality agreement preventing us from coming to you to discuss details about this agreement. They didn't come out and say that. We attended public meetings, and then there was, you know, me saying this. When I say milk the cow, that's what we were hearing from our leadership, milking the cow. What that means, they've been around with us for 20, 30 years, the mining companies. Now is our turn to get our money because they've been extracting and taking the money out of here. Now we want, because we were against it at the back in the 70s. I didn't understand the significance of all this until
so
I kind of got involved.
You're essentially saying, if I understand you, that the leadership, having been involved with these companies for so long, and they had a chance to negotiate with them for more gains, but the price was to keep quiet about it to the wider community, and thereby the community was in the dark about what was actually what the details were. Do I have that right?
Yeah, pretty much. See, when it was a 3-year process, and according to the mayor, it's a 3-year deal negotiation, and the document changed 12 times between the town lawyer and the mining company lawyers. So we were basically trusting our leadership. So at some point, they were going to bring this down to the community level. And when they did, on November 13th, it's on the website, they presented us with a term sheet, a summary of the agreement. And we only had 10, 15 minutes to kind of deal with this at that meeting that night. And I looked at the wording, and one of the words that jumped out at me was the Pine House promises to make reasonable efforts to ensure other Pine House members do not say or do anything that opposes Cameco or Riva's mining operations. And it kind of goes on a bit about other agencies. And so here to us was an immediate gag order at this meeting. And the meeting kind of just exploded because we wanted to understand why will we have to be silenced now? How come if I'm in opposition to the mining companies that this negotiation would rob me the ability to speak out my concerns to the leadership or to my own people, my own community, and my own municipality? And that's what makes it so so devastating, because if it's happening here in Pine House, then it's going to happen other communities at such a large scale, because this is one corporation, the Uranium Corporation. And if this happens to forestry companies and water companies, you mean to tell me that my leaders, my elected representatives, or my Métis Native leaders can negotiate deals without the community seeing the contract until after the signing? So we knew something was very wrong here, but we didn't have the expertise. We didn't know how to look at this information, this document that was in front of us. So when we tried to ask these questions, we kept getting, well, we cannot discuss these details with you because of it's business with business, or, you know, I'm kind of using different words here, but so we weren't getting the answers that we were asking. And because of the confidentiality clause, so here the target date of the signing was about a month and a half away. But so we didn't know how to. By the time we discussed it amongst ourselves, a week had passed, because we just didn't know. It was a shock for us. So we had to get over the emotion, let alone the discussion of what the words actually mean, and then try to make sense of it. You know, what rights were violated? What do we do? And then we ended up trying to put an injunction, and we took around a petition. And within 2 days, we got way over 100 names on that. But then they came out and said, we're still going to sign it. And then we heard that they're going to bump it up to December 12th. Instead of the 31st, the target date, well, that shortened it to a month. So what can we do for a month? So after the signing and everything, we got hold of a lawyer and through other means, and Now the lawsuit is in place. We filed a statement of claim, and now that has, because there's certain agreements upon signing, the community would get $1 million, stuff like that. And so the town is excited that we have the money, but what do we do with it? How do you spend it? So there's a lot of wishing, and things that were left undone could be done now. So it brought hope. Yeah, it was good for the town. The town, in its own way, I suppose, celebrated. But to us, we were devastated. So how do we speak out? How do we voice what's happening to us here? And here, even now, I can come on radio and try to make sense of still the politics that's played, the media manipulation of our own words, of how they interpret the reporters. I'm learning how not to talk to reporters, not to talk to television, because they twist. But I didn't know any of this. And because I had no reason to talk to them before. I just wanted to be left alone. But when a community signs a $200 million deal with a uranium mining company, two companies, who's been around 20, 30 years, and then our community put in to be a one willing host community to look into it for the next 10 years to host a willing dump site, a nuclear waste dump site in our area, in our traditional area. So that settled it for me that I had to begin to search out this information. But what I was finding out was that from my own people, I wasn't getting information that I wanted. The industry provided all kinds of information. It was all set.
Their own propaganda.
Yes. So the documents researching. Had no basis because they'd never been put to use anywhere. So it was all their dreams of what a dump site should be, and the canisters and the storage and all this stuff. But we realized we're not dealing with, it's just a big experiment. And
nothing had been tested. It's just their best case scenario.
Yes, and if they can guarantee it 100 years perfect, and we say, well, if it's the next generation, the next leadership come up with a better solution, they can do whatever they want with it. It'll be right there in the ground, and they'll solve the problem. But this stuff is dangerous. Let's put it somewhere for now, out of the way. And once we do that, we can fill up the nuclear power plants again with this waste. In fact, let's sign a deal with the town of Pine House, and let's triple the production. So, no, they're not going to slow down. Fukushima can happen. But us, what we're hearing is, okay, you know, it's too bad. Few explosions, yeah, it's bad. It's who knows how much contamination, but let's triple the production on our end before 2030. And let's train your children. Let's start educating your children to go into the mining sector.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. When you say your children are being trained to go into the mining sector, how is that manifesting itself in the community?
Well, over the agreement, there's so much tied to it. They have a vision. They had to create a vision. And it's in conflict with, okay, one of the things they're pushing is a holistic healing concept, a holistic wellness for the community. This leadership is really prone that they wanted to use the traditional knowledge and the mapping that was done of traditional activities. They would sell this idea that we want unity, we want health, we want, but under here, under the mining company. And then for them to say, we want to explore our possibilities of being a willing host for a dump site. So it doesn't mix. One way you want to look at traditional activity, you want to secure your land base and then consider that you want to get the money from an industry that's proposing to bring a nuclear waste dump site right into that. So that's a total conflict. So the industry says, well, now you could have pavement on your streets, you can have a new hockey rink, you could expand your gym, you could have an old folks home. Well, first of all, within the Native philosophy, there is no old folks home. We took care of our parents. What we couldn't, they still have the independence if they want. But it was our children or our us that took care of them. That's the traditional way. So an old folks home is a very foreign idea, but this is what's being pushed on the community. And yet you want to talk about holistic healing for the nations, for the community, for the Aboriginal community. And then to bring a hockey rink, and it's fine. It's nice to have recreational activity, but to me, it's kind of like, why don't you expand the fishery? Why don't we teach the kids how to fishery? Well, we're doing it in a small muskrat camps and fishing camps. We're teaching them that. Yeah, but you're not fixing up the actual resources needed. You need to fix the fish plant. A processing plan. You need to fix the cooperative. Well, we will do it in time. Well, we don't know. Well, come, give us ideas. It's just, no, wait a minute. Hold it. We don't want the nuclear waste issue, period. Get rid of that. And get rid of that gag order. Why did you even say it to us? I'll say it in a different way, okay? Here, we say that this gag order is would make reasonable efforts to ensure other Pinehouse people. That basically, in a nutshell, says that my dad can police me and say, son, you shut up about the nuclear industry. I can speak this now because that collaboration agreement allows me to, because it's worded in there. But on the signed of, eventually when they signed it, the wording was taken out because we made such a stink about it. The media caught it, the wording, and went after the guys, after the mayor, Cameco. So eventually that document that was presented to us, the wording changed.
But not the actual
agreement, yes. The agreement, basically, we don't know what changed because we never seen it. Mm-hmm. So, and here we are, they're trying to say, well, we consulted the town. We consulted the town over the collaboration agreement. And just say, okay, so what does that mean? The majority of the town consulted with you when you had quarterly meetings with the community, and you discussed all the details with all the lawyers, the document changed 12 times, blah, blah, blah. And here you finally present this document on a to the community, and it's worded, Pinehouse members promise to make reasonable efforts not to ensure other Pinehouse people do not say or do anything.
That seems to go against the spirit of consultation.
Yes, very much. So the idea is that why would you even put this on a document to present to the town? Is it an outright lie because it wasn't there at the final signing? The agreement, the lettering changed somehow. So why present it to the town? Were you trying to lie to us? Were you trying to deceive us, thinking that if we didn't say anything, it would have passed like that. So when we resisted, well, now we became targets, because now I'm in a lawsuit with my own nation, with my own family. I'm related to the counselors. So I'm suing my own family just to stop this type of manipulation to how things are negotiated. But this is from a high level end of industry. And then on top of that, while we're kind of negotiating about a nuclear waste for our community, because it's still in effect, we're still under that, we're still looking into it, and it's a 10-year process. So the Canada government will say, wow, we just signed another $1 billion deal with China to they're going to buy more uranium. And then Saskatchewan says the same thing. They're making new deals. So what does that make me feel? Okay, you guys aren't going to stop either. You guys are going to ram this down our throat. Deal or no deal, you guys are sold out to this industry. You ain't going to stop. So for you guys to continue with this industry, you need to bury this stuff as fast as you can to any community. So they're going to speed up the regulations. They're going to speed up any environmental laws. They're going to take them down. And that's what's happening right now. We're seeing things that we expect democracy to win out, the consultation to take place to the Canadian public. But you see that it is not happening.
So I guess what you're experiencing in your community is kind of like a microcosm for the way government is going to be approaching other communities across Saskatchewan, even across the country, this whole consultation that isn't really a consultation. What is the most, I mean, because you don't identify, I mean, you're not someone who is, like the, I don't know, look, you use the term shit disturber. You're not by inclination the kind of person who wants to be any kind of a crusader. You just want to be able to go back and harvest your rice and live, live a proud life off the land. And here you are, caught up in a lawsuit, which includes your own family members. What keeps you going? What do you use to sustain yourself through all that?
Well, for one thing, I use my Christianity, my belief in Jesus. But it's been in conflict with other faith believers because I'm suing. So having to justify myself that I'm actually in the right direction to people of like-mindedness, spiritually speaking, it's been a very hard challenge, because this is touching me in areas that my spirituality, my physical relationship with my immediate family, my children, my wife, my dad. And I sometimes just break down. I just break down and I just cry. Sometimes I run to the lake. Sometimes I run because I think different when I'm out in the environment. It's beautiful there. It's peaceful. But for it to be contaminated, there is nothing. If it's contaminated, there is no peace. There is. So I run to my faith. And that seems to be, I run to my wife, my best friend. I run to my faith, and I just cling, and I just cling to what little knowledge I think I have in God. And I brace myself, because as the lawsuit comes out, it seems like the relationships, because I face this on a daily basis. Like I said earlier, I cannot run from my own people, my own community, my own family, because I see him every day. In a city, you can go and have coffee somewhere, not see anybody, not be impacted by them walking by, or how they look at you when they drive by with their trucks and they turn away. Those little gestures that used to be there because you had friendship. There was a community spirit. And when you see this general breakdown of it, you see these little things, these little... When I go shop at the grocery store and it's quiet, nobody wants to talk. You notice the subtle things, and you realize it's affecting you in a very intimate way with your community.
Do you feel like you've been, in some sense, banished? Or is that too strong a word?
It's a very strong word, but it's almost like you just died a little. And you just say, no, I'll live a little harder. I'll get it back someday. Someday this court case will solve everything, and I'll have my friends again. I'll have the fellowship again. I'll have the, maybe not the trust, or because I burned bridges just by being honest, by telling of details, the things that I know, the things people trust me. They come to me because I'm making a stand. They come to me, and I have to be careful what comes out of my mouth, because some of the stuff I hear scares the heck out of me, you know? It's nothing satanic or something violent like that, but it's personal, intimate stuff. They trust me with this knowledge, and I got to keep it and not say anything to anyone of what's really happening on a community level, let alone up in the mines, because people are hungry to know also.
Are you, you don't have to name names, but can you say maybe give a couple of examples of how people are being affected by this? You know, people who want to support you, but they just can't, you know, come out and say anything?
The younger kids, because of that, what they're starting to be impacted with, they want to know, am I safe? The income is great, but am I safe? Is my girlfriend safe? Is my baby going to be safe? They don't want to ask this over there where they're working. And they can't really ask it on a community level because of what's taking place. So the trust issue. And so when they come to me, I have to give them what I think I know. I ain't no expert about safety and millisieverts and all this ways of measuring radiation. I just don't, I can only point the way to them. And one of the examples that I use, and I'm paying a price for it, and I suppose it's already out, but I had a friend who comes out to visit me from the States to go fishing, and one time he headed back home on a rainy day, and he pulled up in the border and he set off the detectors, and he got pulled aside, and they said, "Do you know why we stopped you?" And he said, "No, you set off the radiation detectors. We need to check your vehicle." So they took a handheld Geiger counter and discovered it was the sand in a wheel well. It was underneath the vehicle. And they said, "Where did you come from?" "Up north, Pine House." "Are there uranium mines up there?" "Yeah." "Oh, okay." And that's about the extent of that. So he was let through. He called me the next morning. And what do I do with information like that? Well, he's making it up. It's just a myth, you know. But what do I do really, you know? Does this happen on a daily basis, or is it just vehicles coming from our area? You know, who do I go to for that, for an investigation or setting off radiation detectors? And I've been fishing and living and picking. Man, it just, what is this, you know? So I'm in a court case, and I realize information that comes out of my mouth can kill me in my own community. I don't doubt that it will ever be the same in my town. I thought I would die there. And for me to consider leaving it out of something like this, I never really entertained that thought. Maybe out of ministry or something, you know, a calling, and I go out. And but I always had that I'm going to retire there and grow old there. And for me to consider that I may have to leave, it just rips my heart out. Because I didn't entertain that before, but now I am, and it scares me because I don't have any other place to go. And I don't want other people I don't want it to happen to them too in other communities, to have to just because they're concerned about the uranium industry and the safety of it, let alone deal in the court case or with government bureaucracy, or it's very overwhelming. I just want it to be left alone and live my fishing life. I'm going to be selling my house in my community to my brother and moving across the lake. And I'd like to build a nice little log home. But deep down, I don't know if I could live in it because of what I have to face in my own hometown, because it's just, you might as well say, a stone's throw away. Because I still have to see them to buy my groceries and gas and stuff. And I don't want to be reminded of that. So I don't know if I could ever be free from what's happening now. And for me to think that my children may have to go through things like this at this scale, it can't be. So I look at my children and other people's children and say, no, I got to do something about this now. This ain't about choice anymore. This is a way of life now. And when I had to talk to my wife and saying, yeah, we have to pursue a lawsuit against, because we want accountability from whomever, because something ain't right here, something is terribly wrong. And this is the only avenue we have. And we sat down and we just said, this is our only choice. So we said, we didn't know how it would, what we would be giving up. If I look at it now, it just, I don't know if I would have done it. It's a high price. But I really look at it today, and I said, I wouldn't trade it for the world. I'm in this. I'll do what it takes to fight this, because something was wrong. Something is wrong here in Canada, especially Saskatchewan. But we see in the news, it's Canada. So if we are not part of the problem, then we must be the solution. There's a solution here. And if it's us, then it's very important that we all do something about this, whatever way we can, because everybody's different. And I'm having to talk to people that I would never even dreamed of speaking to, let alone begin to have such dialogue and friendships. And I'm using their resources, their knowledge. And there's a joy in it. There's a beauty in it, because I see this collectiveness taking place. And there is hope more and more. But the odds are so stacked against us because I'm having to not just deal with the prime minister or the premier or the court or corporation. I'm having to deal with my own family in my own hometown. My own immediate family, my own wife, saying, this is hard. It's taking too much of your time. You're losing sleep. I want Dale back. And she pays the price. We all pay. So nobody escapes this.
It's one thing to say stop Harper. It's another thing to say stop Mom, right?
Yes. Yeah. Stop your brother. Stop your uncle. Stop your brother-in-law. Stop your dad. You know, it's very hard to say that. And it requires such a language you never really thought you would ever speak. But I realize I have to make a stand now when all hell is breaking loose in my life. I can't lose control. So my prayer is that I remain standing on my feet. But the beauty of it, my wife stands with me and my children stand with me. And I'm finding that there's a greater community. You can call them activists or whatever, but it's a bigger family, and it's a beautiful family. And a lot of the Christian churches are gaining support because they're having insight also. It's a challenge for them too. So they want what's best, and so many people now want, there's a collectiveness that I see taking place. And that's why I choose to just get up every morning and saying, okay, it's got to be joy today. And sometimes I meet somebody I haven't seen in a while, and they're happy to see me, and I just give them a hug. They hug me. That fills me. It has its place. Now I'm hugging strangers. And that's beautiful. So bring it on, I say. You know, that's where the beauty is, and other people. No matter how different they are. It challenges me, you know, faith-wise and stuff, but I look past those things. And I look for the true essence of what I believe love is. And I'm still learning. I'm sure making mistakes too.
Do you have maybe a message for people outside your community, you know, to... You lend assistance to your cause as well as to for the greater cause, you know, in terms of protecting these precious resources. I mean, is there maybe if you could only say one thing to that wider constituency, what would that be?
For us to come out here, coming from the north, our resources are limited. There's three of us that are involved in a court case in my community, and the living is tough because we choose not to go to the mines. And because of the resistance, it's very hard on us. They don't want to talk about it, my friends. But I see it. They might not like it, me sharing this, but they're struggling financially. They're proud. They want to resist, but sometimes they don't have the gas to even get here. My wife had to cut hair. Yeah, I know the Council of Canadians were paying for this trip, this conference, for my gas, but I didn't have it. I had to get here just to get that. And the Committee for Future Generations have some finances, but it's limited at times. So we're still very new to this, but it's getting there. So financially, yes. And also the lawyer fees. I think that's the biggest crunch right now. Is when he said we sat down, he said, you guys, there was no way you guys can afford me. Of course, we never could. But he made his sacrifices, and there are sacrifices, especially on his part. I don't know what kind of pressure he feels, but there's a lot of pressure there for all of us. And even them to get that help with their finances, the lawyer fees, that would be a blessing that would, I don't know what joy that would bring. It might not be everything, but every little bit helps. And it shows the support, it shows the love, and the forgiveness also, because it's easy to build up walls. It's easier to lash back. But when we hold back, we're having to tell each other just to keep, you know, be quiet. Don't swear, don't, because we're learning how to deal with people, and we ain't perfect. So we, and money has puts pressure, especially with some of the other individuals that are, we do have some support on a community level. People pat us on the back, but they cannot speak out, and we understand that. So I understand that people out there may not readily understand what's really happening on the grassroots level. But even helping us, you'd be surprised how little people do. That just brings such joy to us, to just persevere. And the little things really matter. And we wouldn't be able to see that without the struggle being so tough on us, especially up north, because we do live in an isolated community, and we don't have a good name, you might as well. It's been turned on us. So whatever support, whatever thank you or help, you know, go on the website, just let us know that you're praying for us, you're thinking of us. And it's amazing, some of the things that other people have said to us. And it just spurs us on. And sometimes it gets very tough, almost too unbearable. But there's always hope.
Dale Smith, I want to thank you very much for sharing your story with our listeners. Miigwech.
You're welcome. Thank you.
We've been listening to an exclusive interview with Dale Smith, Pine House resident and activist with the Committee for Future Generations. For more on this issue, please visit committeeforfuturegenerations.wordpress.com. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can hear our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across the country. We are broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next.